Hello, everyone. A little while ago, I had a wonderful discussion about the story in Genesis in which Joseph brings his family down to live in Egypt. The discussion was held on the Word in Black and Red podcast with the host over there, Micah, the wise old llama, NB. It's not a passage that I've done on my podcast, but our discussion was so meaningful to me that I asked if I could share it with you. So here it is, as a bonus episode. Do take note of the content warning at the beginning. It is not just a joke.
The following podcast is banned in the state of Florida for talking about a dangerous leftist book, the Bible. Like the Bible, this podcast contains frank discussions on sensitive topics, including sex, violence, and cursing. Please proceed with caution.
The wicked draw their swords and bend bows to bring down the weak and the needy, to slaughter those whose way is right. But the sword of the wicked will enter their own hearts, their bows will be broken. Better is the little that the righteous have than the overabundant wealth of the wicked. The arms of the wicked will be broken, the Lord supports the just. This is the Word in Black and Red.
Hello, and welcome to the Word in Black and Red, where we read the Bible from a leftist and liberationist perspective to elucidate the way people of faith and their comrades can understand the Bible as a source of healing, love, and liberation for all people. I am your host, Michael Belong, the wise old llama MB, joined today once again by the wonderful W. Scott McCandless from the Retelling the Bible podcast. If you are not already listening to that podcast, please go and do it. I am in the middle of the second season right now. And I just, the story has come to life in all of these new ways. I was just listening to the one about Balaam's donkey. And in an unusual fashion, Scott decided to actually keep the mystical elements in that story.
No other way to tell it.
No, there really isn't. Unlike the sort of, not hyper-rationalistic, but a naturalistic explanation that he often gives for the stories that I really enjoy. But Balaam's donkey, you can't get around the ass talking in that one. And dear listener, my apologies if you are listening to this in the future and you're wondering, why in the world does Micah sound so muffled? Well, it's because I'm wearing a mask to protect the health of my family, as I was exposed to COVID, and I'm hoping to not spread that on to anybody else. All that to be said, we'll go ahead and dive right on in to the story of Joseph coming out to his brothers. Genesis 45 through 47, 12. Joseph could no longer control himself in front of all his attendants, so he declared, "Everyone, leave now." So no one stayed with him when he revealed his identity to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians and Pharaoh's household heard him. Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm Joseph. Is my father really still alive?" His brothers couldn't respond because they were terrified before him. Joseph said to his brothers, "Come closer to me," and they moved closer. He said, "I'm your brother Joseph, the one you sold to Egypt. Now don't be upset and don't be angry with yourselves that you sold me here. Actually, God sent me before you to save lives. We've already had 2 years of famine in the land, and there are 5 years left without planting or harvesting. God sent me before you to make sure you'd survive and to rescue your lives in this amazing way. You didn't send me here. It was God who made me a father to Pharaoh, master of his entire household, and ruler of the whole land of Egypt. Hurry, go back to your father. Tell him this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me master of all of Egypt. Come down to me. Don't delay. You may live in the land of Goshen, so you will be near me, your children, your grandchildren, your flocks, your herds, and everyone with you. I will support you there, so you, your household, and everyone with you won't starve, since the famine will still last 5 years. You and my brother Benjamin have seen with your own eyes that I am speaking to you. Tell my father about my power in Egypt and about everything you've seen. Hurry and bring my father down here." He threw his arms around his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his shoulder. He kissed all of his brothers and wept, embracing them, After that, his brothers were finally able to talk to him. When Pharaoh's household heard the message, Joseph's brothers have arrived, both Pharaoh and his servants were pleased. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Give your brothers these instructions. Load your pack animals and go back to the land of Canaan. Get your father and your households and come back to me. Let me provide you with good things from the land of Egypt, so that you may eat the land's best food. Give them these instructions too. Take wagons from the land of Egypt for your children and wives, and pick up your father and come back. Don't worry about your possessions, because you will have good things from the entire land of Egypt." So Israel's sons did that. Joseph gave them wagons as Pharaoh instructed, and he gave them provisions for the road. To all of them he gave a change of clothing, but to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of clothing. To his father he sent 10 male donkeys carrying goods from Egypt, 10 female donkeys carrying grain and bread, and rations for his father for the road. He sent his brothers off, and as they were leaving, he told them, "Don't be worried about the trip." So they left Egypt and returned to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan. They announced to him, "Joseph's still alive. He's actually ruler of all the land of Egypt." Jacob's heart nearly failed, and he couldn't believe them. When they told him everything Joseph had said to him, and when he saw the wagons Joseph had sent to carry him, Jacob recovered. Then Israel said, "This is too much. My son Joseph is still alive. Let me go and see him before I die." Israel packed up everything he owned and traveled to Beersheba. There he offered sacrifices to his father Isaac's God. God said to Israel in a vision at night, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "I'm here." He said, "I am El, your father's God. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt, because I will make a great nation of you there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I promise to bring you out again. Joseph will close your eyes when you die." Then Jacob left Beersheba. Israel's sons put their father Jacob, their children, and their wives in the wagons Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They took their livestock and their possessions that they had acquired in the land of Canaan and arrived in Egypt. Jacob and all of his children with him, his sons and grandsons, his daughters and his granddaughters, all of his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. These are the names of the Israelites who went to Egypt, including Jacob and his sons. Jacob's oldest son was Reuben. Reuben's sons were Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. Simeon's sons were Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shaul, whose mother was a Canaanite. Levi's sons were Gershon, Kothon, and Merari. Judah's sons were Er, Onan, Shelah, Perez, and Zerah. Er and Onan both died in the land of Canaan. Perez's sons were Hezron and Hamul. Issachar's sons were Tola, Puva, Iob, and Shimron. Zebulon's sons were Sered, Elon, and Jalil. These are the sons Leah bore to Jacob in Padam Aram. Her daughter was Dinah. All of these persons, including his sons and daughters, totaled 33. Gad's sons were Ziphion, Haggai, Shunai, Esbon, Eri, Erodai, and Areli. Asher's sons were Imnah, Ishvi, Beriah, and their sister Sarah. Beriah's sons were Hibar and Malchiel. These are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to his daughter Leah. She bore these to Jacob, a total of 16 persons. The sons of Jacob's wives Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. To Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim. Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of Heliopolis, bore them to him. Benjamin's sons were Bela, Becher, Ashbel, Gera, Naaman, Ehi, Rosh, Mupim, Hupim, and Ard. These are Rachel's sons who were born to Jacob, a total of 14 persons. Dan's son was Hushim. Naphtali's sons were Jezeel, Guni, Jezer, and Shillem. These are the sons of Bilhah, whom Laban gave to his daughter Rachel. She bore these to Jacob, a total of 7 persons. All of the persons going to Egypt with Jacob, his own children, excluding Jacob's sons' wives, totaled 66 persons. Joseph's sons born to him in Egypt were 2 persons. Thus all of the persons of Jacob's household going to Egypt totaled 70. Israel had sent Judah ahead to Joseph so that Joseph could explain the way to Goshen. Then they arrived in the land of Goshen. Joseph hitched up his chariot and went up to meet his father Israel in Goshen. When he arrived, he threw his arms around his neck and wept, embracing him for a long time. Israel said to Joseph, "I can die now after seeing your face. You are really still alive." Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "Let me go up and inform Pharaoh and tell him, 'My brothers and my father's household, who are in the land of Canaan, have arrived.' The men are shepherds, because they own livestock. They brought with them their flocks and herds and everything they own. When Pharaoh summons you and says, "What do you do?" say, "Your servants have owned livestock since we were young, both we and our ancestors, so that you will be able to settle in the land of Goshen, since Egyptians think all shepherds are beneath their dignity." Joseph went to inform Pharaoh and said, "My father and brothers with their flocks, herds, and everything they own have come from the land of Canaan and are now in the land of Goshen." From all of his brothers, he selected 5 men and presented them before Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph's brothers, "What do you do?" They said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and our ancestors." They continued, "We've come to the land as immigrants because the famine is so severe in the land of Canaan that there are no more pastures for your servants' flocks. Please allow your servants to settle in the land of Goshen." Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since your father and brothers have arrived, the land of Egypt is available to you. Settle your father and brothers in the land's best location. Let them live in the land of Goshen. And if you know capable men among them, put them in charge of my own livestock." Joseph brought his father Jacob and gave him an audience with Pharaoh. Jacob blessed Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How old are you?" Jacob said to Pharaoh, "I have been a traveler for 130 years. My years have been few and difficult. They don't come close to the years my ancestors lived during their travels." Jacob blessed Pharaoh and left Pharaoh's presence. Joseph settled his father and brothers and gave them property in the land of Egypt, in the best location in the land of Ramses, just as Pharaoh had ordered. Joseph provided food for his father, his brothers, and his father's entire household, in proportion to the number of children. So, once again, a weird little story. A story where we first have Joseph revealing his identity to his brothers, a story that then goes into the logistics of moving a household to Egypt from Canaan to escape the rest of the famine that would be there for the next 5 years. And then this negotiation of where the people of Israel are meant to live in this land of Goshen that is set aside for them. So really these three things that are sort of the beginning, middle, and end of this reunification of this family that happens in this way.
I mean, the thing that really strikes me about this one is that if you just took this on its own, it's all like this good news story. You know, it's all a happily ever after. Yep. And the thing that really bothers me about this is there's always this danger of minimizing or underestimating the terrible suffering and the horrible things that have left up to this. I mean, Joseph has just been through hell over I don't know how many years, you know, sold into slavery. He's been accused, falsely accused. He's been thrown in prison. He's just been through the worst time ever. And the real big temptation, I think, that comes with this story is, oh, well, happy ending. Everything is okay. That's where I find this story really meets with people where they are. Because I don't know about you, but in ministry, you deal with people who have all kinds of suffering. And
oh, yeah.
It even sounds like you've had that kind of day, even just today.
Yes,
you know, and absolutely. You know, a day when just everything goes so very wrong. Well, Joseph has just had, I don't know how many years, where everything's just gone so very wrong. And it's all his brother's fault, you know? And yes, it's wonderful in that it's a story of forgiveness and all of that. And, you know, at some point, yes, it's wonderful to get to a point where you can put that behind you and be reconciled with some of these really important people in your life. But the temptation of just underestimating every little bit of suffering that has led up to this is the problem, the thing I struggle with. And of course, the really big thing, and this is where it really connects with a lot of people, is Joseph says that in so many words, right? Yeah. Joseph speaks to them and he says, hey, all of these terrible things happened. You guys did it to me. I'm looking at you, Reuben. I'm looking at you, Judah. You put me through all of this. But God did it. You guys didn't do this. God did it. God sent me to preserve you, a remnant on earth, to keep alive for many survivors. It was not you who sent me here, but God. And I don't know how many people I have encountered over the years who, when they have just had the worst possible events, you know, this terrible, terrible thing that's happened to them, And I could tell you stories, and I'm sure you could tell stories too, of the horrible things that people have lived through.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, well, if this horrible, horrible thing happened to me, it must be because God had a plan. Therefore, God decided to put me through this hell.
Yeah.
And I have some trouble with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we even see it in the Jesus story, right? Where it's like, not my will, but yours be done, right? That Jesus is so fearful of the suffering he's about to go through that he goes, okay, God, it's up to you, right? You can put me through this if you want me to, which is certainly the way that I grew up reading that story, right? That like, this was inevitable. There was nothing that could be done, right? And Jesus was just putting up with it. And here in this story, like, it's very much so sort of that sort of way where it's like, yeah, I went through all that shit, but I see that it's so that I could be in this scenario to help you now, right? But I think that a much more radical reading of that text is Jesus not saying, this is inevitable, God, you know, is making me suffer through this, but instead Jesus recognizing, oh, suffering is an inevitable part of life. That doesn't mean that God has caused it to happen to me, right? It doesn't mean that God is making me die on the cross, right? But instead that suffering happens, particularly when you are someone who radically loves people and threatens the system of power as it exists. That's probably more likely to cause you suffering because you enter into the suffering of other human beings, right? You enter into the suffering of the other people around you. And that's exactly what the incarnation is this entering into the suffering of the people around you. Now, I don't think Joseph does that all that much, but but I do think it is oftentimes a good trauma response for people who have been through a lot of suffering to say, oh, I can explain why this suffering happened. But I think a lot better of a way of saying it is not that, like, I went through this so that I could experience, you know, so that I could help you, but I went through this and I can help you. Like, yeah. I don't have to have a purpose for my suffering to experience suffering. I just have. And now, because of that experience, I'm in a better position to help you. That doesn't make my suffering okay. Like, it doesn't wipe away the pain that's already there.
Yeah. It's that there's a subtle difference there, but yes, I mean, absolutely. I've known so many people who have gone through horrible events and have decided to create something good out of it. You know, they lost a, you know, horrible event. They lost a child in a horrible accident, and yet they decide to enter into some efforts in society to say, well, how can we create a more safe situation for children? Yeah. In the future. So they try and build something good out of their horrible experience. And that's good. It doesn't take away the pain. It doesn't take away the loss. And it doesn't make it okay. But still, they can bring something good out of it. And honestly, having that kind of attitude, if I can bring something good out of this horrible tragedy that I lived through, that's actually, that's good for you. It gives you a purpose moving forward, and we all need a purpose, but that's not the same thing as giving the suffering itself a purpose. That's the subtle difference. And, you know, the other place where you could, if you start pushing this idea to the extreme, which of course people do, you are desperately looking for a reason for all kind of suffering, and you end up down in Florida with their educational curriculum, where they decide to teach everybody, well, slaves learned useful skills as slaves, therefore it was okay. Well, obviously not. That's ridiculous. Yeah. And, you know, that in some way this justifies in any sense the horrible suffering that people get put through. That's the line we can't cross. We can't justify suffering. We can't justify evil committed against people. And people committed evil against Joseph. There's no question. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's a really good, just like a really good test of like would I say this about an enslaved person? Like, did the enslaved person's suffering bring about something, you know, was able to make them better? A lot of people were able to use their experience of slavery and turn it into something positive. That doesn't mean they deserved the slavery. No. Like, that doesn't mean that God caused them to be a slave. And it would be ridiculous to say that.
No, so, it's a testimony to the resilience of the person who survived a horrible thing. And that's all.
Yeah.
There's something extraordinary about them if, yes, they were able to build a life for themselves. But it in no way says anything good about the institution of slavery or the masters who decided to let their slaves learn something for their own benefits, of course, for the benefit of the slaveholder, because that was the only reason they would let somebody learn something. I think there's actually an indication of this problem in the story itself. The part where there is a moment, right, when it all comes out, when Joseph finally reveals himself to his brothers. And then it says, and I am just captivated by this description. It says he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. So this cry, and it's a cry of absolute anguish, and it's described as echoing throughout the entire land of Egypt, right?
Yeah.
And the household of Pharaoh, which would have been huge.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is obviously, you know, physically impossible that a cry could echo that loud. So it's obviously, it's an image of just a depth of sorrow and pain and anguish that is emanating from this guy for everything he's been through. And I would suggest if it echoes as far as the household of Pharaoh, surely it echoes as far as God.
Yeah.
And that God has to be feeling that absolute anguish just as deeply as anybody else. So let's whatever we do, yes, absolutely. You live through a tragedy and you try and build some good and bring some good out of it, and that helps you and it helps the world, but in no way justifies or justifies the evil or the sorrow or the horrible thing that has been done to you.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. And you know, this phrase that I keep reading throughout the Bible again and again and again is, and God heard their cries and God answered them, right? And that's what's happening here in this story, right? God heard Joseph's cry and God answered. But it's not a, like, God heard their cry and said, oh, you're getting better because of this, or I'm going to, because of your suffering, I'm going to bring about this sort of thing. It is very explicitly a, I hear the suffering you're going through, and I'm coming to alleviate you of it, right? And a lot of the ways that that suffering has caused, the Old Testament, and particularly the Torah, will go on to say, well, you know what that suffering is like, so don't do that to other people, right? You know, you were once a stranger in a strange land is the most often repeated single phrase in the entire Bible. It's not love others. It's not, you know, do not judge. It's nothing like that. It is, remember, you were strangers in a strange land. Care for the immigrant because you were strangers in a strange land. And that basic empathy is the foundation of this text. Not that your suffering is justified, but you know what it is like to suffer. So don't make other people suffer in the same way.
Mm-hmm. And bring about some good in the world where you can. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. The other thing that I love about this reveal is his family doesn't recognize him for lots of reasons, right? Joseph is wearing all the makeup, right? The signifiers of the land of Egypt. And his family doesn't recognize him because he's caked in this stuff. You know, he's got the really fly Egyptian eyelashes and the, you know, the thing on his chin and everything. And I can't help but think of that in two ways. First off, that they're finally seeing him in the power that he knew he had at the very beginning. But the other thing that he had at the very beginning was a princess dress, right? This very feminine clothing that he was given. And then, you know, he's finally living into this place and into this look that is very defined by makeup, that's very defined by things that would typically be thought of as more feminine, perhaps even in their own culture. that, you know, but certainly in our culture, looks like drag, right? This guy who's wearing all this makeup, who's not fitting into the gender stereotypes that we certainly have of what masculinity is. And it's only when he begins to weep, when he begins to cry, that they finally realize, oh, okay, and maybe that makeup gets washed away and they see him as what they remember him. And recognize, oh, this powerful person, this person in drag, is who this person really is. You know, we see him both as what he once was and who he is now, as he was always meant to be.
I can also well imagine that in the depth or, you know, the power of grief, you know, all of the Egyptian, you know, manners and culture and all of that stuff probably falls away, and he goes back to who he was as a boy. You know, deep grief and sorrow has a way of bringing out your most, you know, take you back to your childhood in a sense. And maybe there was a bit of that going on too. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that they're just all frozen. Like, they can't do anything. It's like he starts crying, and only after he's gotten all the tears out, then they're like, oh, okay, now we can talk. Like, they're just shocked that this incredibly powerful person has suddenly become vulnerable in this way. And, like, you know, all of the emotions that they must be going through. Oh, you know, I thought I killed this guy. I thought, you know, my conscience has never been cleared from this.
And, yes.
And all these sort
and
of
things.
And
is he going to kill me now? But yes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Certainly. There's certainly a lot of that going on as well.
But isn't it interesting that it's, you know, it very clearly says, you know, we need to leave a little place for weeping and crying and feeling the depth of the sorrow and loss here before we can move on. There is a place for grief. It's a necessary place for what people have suffered. We can't just say, oh, forget about all that stuff. You know, you can't say, well, what can't say to these people who've been abused or colonized or whatever in the past, oh, let's forget about the past. Let's move on. We have to deal with that stuff before we can find a way to find reconciliation, peace, whatever needs to happen now.
Yeah. And yeah, it is amazing that grief is like a very acknowledged part of all of that, that Jacob and Esau weep at each other, that Isaac weeps over the death of his mother, that Isaac weeps over the arrival of his wife, you know, all of these things where weeping is like a key part of what's happening here. And I think that weeping is, you know, Israel's name is the one who wrestles with God. And I think weeping is an important part of wrestling with God. Like, if we haven't shed a few tears over our faith, like, then have we not experienced all that it means to be human?
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Because our faith is one that isn't just the happy, happy, clappy, clappy, joy, joy that we see on the Trinity Broadcasting Network or whatever is going on. You know, it's not just all happy smiles. It's not just saying I'm fine to the people you're seeing at church. It is this recognition that grief is a real part of our experience. There's a whole book of the Bible called Lamentations. It's, you know, that might as well be, you know, cross that out and say, cry with me, bro.
And a good half of the Psalms are laments too, as well, when you're getting down to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And a lot of them don't end with a happy resolve either. They leave you in that depth of despair. And here, like, you come out of it, right? You begin with this great despair and then come out of it. But for a lot of the people who are reading this story in ancient Israel and, you know, in the midst of Babylonian exile, they're still in that crying phase. Like, they're still in that grief phase. They have not yet gotten to settling in the land of Egypt.
Mm-hmm. But they need to get through that. Yeah. I think we have this tendency to want to because it's scary, grief.
Yeah.
Weeping is scary. We want to short circuit that. And in some ways, that whole thing about, you know, finding a purpose behind suffering is a way of trying to short-circuit the feelings. One family that I will never forget, this is several years ago, one of my early churches that I worked in, there was a couple in that church who years before I ever saw them, they lost a child. Like a 9-year-old beautiful girl lost her to cancer. It was a horrible, horrible story. And the minister at that time, one of my predecessors at the funeral, got up and explained the whole thing to this family. Said, oh, well, she was this child who died, was too good for this world, so God wanted her, and so God took her. And let me tell you, I came to that couple decades later, and they were still stuck on why on earth God would want to take their daughter.
Yeah.
Understandably, because that was the worst. I mean, honestly, in most cases, someone's deep in grief, coming along and saying an explanation for the suffering you've gone through doesn't help at all. But that's about one of the worst possible explanations you can try.
Yeah.
But, you know, some people are just so desperate to say, oh, there's a reason, so you can be okay. Yeah. And it's just does so much damage. That for that couple, their concept of God never recovered from that.
Yeah.
No, and understandably. It's, our rush to give a purpose can be very, very damaging. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and like Joseph's suffering in this narrative has a purpose, right? Like, but it is set up as a fictional narrative, right? That has that arc, that has that purpose, that does those sort of things. But the thing about fiction is that it's not real. And as much truth as we can get out of this story, right, as much as I believe this is God's word because it has something to teach us, we have to recognize that the genre is different from the genre of real life. In real life, shit happens.
And sometimes we have no idea why. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
We may never know.
And we can, the best that we can do afterwards is go and apply a purpose to it, right? But I don't think that even applying a purpose is very useful a lot of the time. There's a lot of things that you can say, I got the skills only because I went through this experience. And maybe be thankful that you have those skills, but that doesn't mean...
Doesn't make you thankful for the suffering, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, absolutely. Exactly. I am very grateful that I am now seeing my doctor a lot more to, you know, make sure that the cancer doesn't come back. That doesn't mean that I'm happy I got the cancer in the first place,
no,
you know?
No, absolutely, yeah.
You know, and cancer is just one of these things that happens, you know, and it doesn't have to mean anything other than that, except that when it did happen, I had to get my priorities straight and say, mm-hmm. what are the things that I want to spend my time doing if this is the only time I have left, right?
Yeah. And how can you maybe down the road help other people who struggle with cancer diagnosis or something like that?
Yeah.
You will continue to bring good things out of it. I have no doubt, but it's not because God decided you should have cancer so that you could do this good thing. No.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not the way to look at it. Yeah.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And also, I will shout out and say that I think one of the people that has really meant the most to me throughout this process of creating this podcast is one of the things that I think is the best benefits of me having had cancer. But why? Because he had gone through the same experience and it sucked. And I don't wish that he had gone through it. Uh-huh. But because he had gone through it, he was able to say, hey, this is what sucks about all this thing. And I get where you're coming from. And I understand the frustrations you're having. And I understand, you know, even the sympathy that people are trying to have, the way that it can come across as not what you need. And he was able to just be there and love me through it. Not because he deserved the suffering so that I would have a better time. Mm-hmm. But I am very deeply, deeply grateful for that. So I won't say his name because he's wonderful and I don't know if he has shared that for with sure. the wider community. But if you are in the Discord and want to get to know that person, I'm sure that he will share his life with you as well. The next little section that is interesting is the brothers returning for Jacob. And I love this little note that Joseph gives a change of clothing for all of his brothers, which is a big deal, right? Like a change of clothing is something that you have to hand stitch. This is not, you know, we're not in the era of fast fashion. You had one outfit and, mm-hmm. and when it got dirty, you got naked, you go out and had your, you know, once a month bath and you washed your clothes while you were doing it. And so like the idea that someone has a change of clothing, crazy, the idea that you give somebody five changes of clothing even more radical. Like, you're giving him a whole wardrobe. He's going to be fabulous. You know, Joseph is doing no favors for himself here if he's trying to not look queer. giving himself a whole makeover. So anyway, in this little passage that, again, instead of taking things from them, giving them more than they ever asked for, giving them the 300 pieces of silver, which is many times over the amount that Joseph had been paid, had been sold off for, right? And so it's using the same currency to say, our relationship is worth so much more to me than the thing that had once been done to me, right? And that the things that you attempted to do wrong to me, I will answer back in great kindness, right? Many times over. Instead of engaging in I'm going to strike you, you're going to strike me, back and forth, this incredible generosity that is the root of forgiveness that actually solves this conflict. In game theory, there is basically, if you have two competing opponents and one is able to attack and then the other is able to attack, if you both attack, you end up completely destroyed. If you both don't attack, eventually there's some conflict where one power attacks first and you begin one of these other problems. But so often in those game theories, when one person is being attacked and simply doesn't respond in kind, that is actually what causes the peace in so many of those scenarios, is just not responding in kind. And so we see throughout the book of Genesis, over and over and over again, hurt people hurting people, where one person gets attacked, is raised by in a relationship that doesn't seem healthy, Abraham going to sacrifice his firstborn son, where he had actually had a firstborn son ahead of Isaac, but rejected him in favor of Isaac. And then Isaac continues that tradition and rejects, in reverse, right? He embraces his firstborn son, Esau, rejecting his secondborn son, Jacob. But God saying, no, that's the person I'm going to go through. And then Jacob favoring one son over another, right? We see the cycle of favoritism that has hurt this family for so many generations. And Joseph could absolutely do that here and say, come, let me be the favorite, right? But instead he interrupts and says, I'm going to give you back so much more than I have been given. So that everyone here is able to benefit, because I'm not going to escalate this conflict any longer. So it continues on when the household actually moves to Egypt. There's a couple of interesting notes here that seem to define the way that Egyptians treated the Israelites. So earlier in the story, we see Egyptians won't sit down with the Hebrews because they think that they're above them and so won't share a meal with them. And then the fact that Egyptians seem to look down on sheep herders. And so they send, go off to the land of Goshen, have your land there. Goshen is this interesting, well, first off, you know, the Egyptians saw the world the other way around than we do. They saw what we would consider the southern part of the Nile to be the upper part of the Nile and the northern part to be the lower part. And so they were sent to lower Egypt, to Goshen, this part closest to the Mediterranean Sea, where they were sent to go and raise their livestock and whatnot. It's one of the places that is not very desertified in Egypt, and so you're able to grow a lot more flocks and herds.
Yeah, better for pasture, whereas the Nile Valley itself is better for agriculture, of course, because of the flooding river, right? Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So,
which sort of seems, it sort of seems like Joseph is saying, guys, this is the place we want. This is where we want to be. This is perfect for us, but we don't really want to think that that's what we want. So what we're going to do is we're going to tell them that we're shepherds, and that's where they're going to send us, because they think that we're not acceptable. But really, this is the best place for us. It's pretty wise negotiation on the part of. I think he's just a little bit manipulative, this guy.
Yeah.
And he knows he's got Pharaoh wrapped around his finger.
Almost like he's good at his job or something and gets what he wants most of the time. Yeah, and so he does manipulate them in this way. I also like this little line where they're trying to number up the number of people and all the families. If you just look at the text in the different families, there are 33 and then 16. That's 49 so far. And then you add a total of 14 more persons. So 49 plus 14 is 63. And then you have the seven persons from Bilhah. And so that totals 70. But for some reason, the text then says, all the persons going to Egypt with Jacob, his own children, excluding Jacob's sons' wives, totaled 66 persons. Well, the wives weren't included in this original text. So the 70 persons are suddenly boiled down to 66 persons. And apparently only four of Jacob's sons were married while they had all these kids to exclude them. Yeah, so yeah. Anyway, there's some funny math going on there.
Funny math. Well, a couple of them are dead, too. Don't forget that Ur and Onan are dead, so they don't
That's
go
true.
Down to
That's
Egypt.
True.
There's a whole story about that, as we remember.
Yeah. Oh, maybe that's where the number is. Well, still, that isn't 60. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's not 66. Maybe two other people just died anonymously. I suppose Dina died.
Well,
so we're missing one dead person.
Yeah, she wouldn't have come with them anyways, if I remember how that story ended. Yes, if she wasn't dead. Yeah.
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 So, and then Joseph's sons were born to him were two persons. So then we have Joseph, but we can't count his wife because she's one of Jacob's sons' wives. So you're left with 69 people who, and three, yeah, that's true. But three of them didn't go down to him with him to Egypt. So 66 persons went. But if you add up the number over here, it's actually 70. So there's some weird fucking math going on here. And so when someone tells you the Bible is infallible, tell them to just read this bizarre passage and the fact that you can't reconcile these numbers. I've seen people try. I have seen people try so hard to reconcile these numbers. But you just can't.
Well, and that 70, you know that 70's got to be symbolic anywhere. But anyways, because that 70 keeps coming up. That's how many, what, generations that Matthew says are in the ancestors of Jesus is 70, right? And that's the 70 years of, 70 years in Babylon when probably this story was being written. So there's that too, so. Yep.
70 is the number of people that Jesus sends out with the disciples to go spread his word. 70 is this number that comes up all over the place in weird ways, right? We've talked previously about 10 and about 7. They're both significant. And so the 10 and 7 here being combined in this interesting way. Someone pointed out to me that I often talk about numerology and then I don't explain it. And that is because I don't think that there are very good theories on the numerology in a lot of texts. And so I just try to make the connections between them without coming down definitively and saying 7 means completeness, which, like, it does kind of, but also it means other things.
Yeah.
So,
it means different things in different cultures too. And
there's just this funny little verse that just doesn't make sense in the text. And so 46:26 just leaves you with a different conclusion. And so when people try to say the Bible is infallible, like, this is evidence right here. The Bible is not infallible. And the people writing the Bible didn't think it was infallible. That's a much later doctrine that ends up coming down.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that Ephraim and Manasseh, there's stories about them who are supposed to be born in Egypt. There's stories in the Book of Chronicles of them running around back in the land of Israel and having descendants for generations and generations. So there's that too. So
yeah. So, but anyway, so I just like that in this last little bit that first that we're establishing very early on in the Bible that shepherds, like, despite shepherds being the person that God chose, that these Egyptians, like in the form of Cain and Abel, that God chose Abel, the shepherd, over Cain, the farmer, that here, these farmers, these Pharaoh, you know, and all the famine, they're saved by a dirty sheep herder And and then these dirty sheep herders come into the land, and these dirty sheep herders will go on to become the king of Israel, right? That David was a dirty sheep herder. And then, of course, the Lord is my shepherd, right? That God is often associated with the shepherding. You know, Nietzsche, in the Genealogy of Morality, says that the Judeo-Christian faith are the weaklings, right? The underdogs and all those sorts of things. And Nietzsche is absolutely right there, that we worship a God who has taken the underside, who has chosen the sheep herders, who has chosen the people who are dirty and on the bottom and, you know, sent off to that less desirable land. And those are the people that God chooses. Consistently, that God is constantly on the side of the dirty, on the lower, on the oppressed. And here in this story, that again, these are the people that God uses to bring about the salvation of all people, right here in the land of Egypt, and then later on in the person of Jesus Christ, where some of his first visitors are, in stark contrast, on the one hand, the angels from heaven, and on the other hand, the shepherds from earth.
The shepherds from Bethlehem.
Yes. Yeah. The last little thing that I like here in this verse, and I love the Common English Bible for a lot of reasons. I held off on it for a long time because it was edited by one of my seminary professors that I have to confess was not my favorite. But I have to hand it to the CEB. It's quite good a lot of the time. In verse 9 of 47, Jacob said to Pharaoh, "I've been a traveler for 130 years. My years have been few and difficult." And so, like, you know, way earlier in the text, longtime listeners will remember, there's this little line that says, "And God limited the years of humans to 120 years. And here, way after that point, Jacob is complaining that he only gets to live 130 years.
Only had, yeah.
My years have been few.
That is kind of striking. Yeah.
My years have been few and difficult. I've only seen my great-grandchildren running around here and doing all these sorts of things. But, you know, Jacob has had a difficult life through all of this.
He lived to see his sons apparently kill his son. He's been through a bit of hell here and there,
yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And, like, it is impressive that he was able to live this long and good life. From his perspective, a difficult life. But that it is able to bring him back around and do these sort of things. And Jacob has the ability that his father did not have. He has more than one blessing. And so Jacob is able to bless even Pharaoh in this way.
Blesses Pharaoh. Yeah. Blesses all of his children, too, yep. Of course, little bit after this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very touching thing that Jacob blesses the Pharaoh. And I think it's repeated twice, too.
Mm-hmm.
In verse 7 and then verse 10, he blesses the Pharaoh twice. It just sort of comes out of nowhere, and it just really kind of struck me. And, of course, he's this shepherd that Pharaoh and the Egyptians look down at, but just he has somehow earned this right to bless probably the most powerful person on the face of the earth at that time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, and that, like, again, shows the power of the God of Israel, right? This declaration, I am El, the one who leads you, and that God is able to bless even the most powerful person on earth through this little shepherd guy. And again, speaks to the greatness of the nation that will come afterward. The last thing I want to say is that here Joseph is really taking care of his family. And, like, this redemptive arc is super important and super, you know, bringing this family back together in this way. And then in the next section, we're going to see Joseph use the power that brought his family back together to break apart the power of others, right? Again, that hurt people hurt people. And so he is going to bring about the debt enslavement and the poverty to a lot of the rest of the land of Egypt that will in turn result in the enslavement of his family as well. And so, you know, there is a way to stop this violence, but it is to not be a part of creating a system that will enslave you as well and enslave your people as well.
And we will, we're on to talk about this next week, right?
Yep, exactly. So,
yes, so. because it doesn't quite go so well.
Yes.
Yeah, and here we see, you know, at the end of this story that we read, Joseph is choosing to give to his family, you know, providing his family, when it comes actually to the Egyptians, all of these common folk from whom we're getting into the next episode, from whom he's taken all of this food, they have to buy it.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
With ultimately their bodies.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So.
Yeah.
But yes, that's I actually, in preparation to talk about that next week, I'm actually putting out an episode of my podcast tomorrow morning on how Joseph enslaved Egypt.
Oh, awesome, awesome.
and so because I knew that we were talking about this, I decided to tell the story. So.
That's fantastic. Yeah, check out Scott's version of the next story in 8.2 of Retelling the Bible Wherever Fine Podcasts Are Found. It's just such a fun time. So I listen to a lot of Bible podcasts in preparation for this podcast, but I think that Retelling the Bible is pretty easily in my top three favorites of episodes to listen to. Well, Scott, thank you so much for being a part of this conversation, as always. It's such a pleasure to have you. and thank you, dear listener, for being a part of this community and all that you're doing and sticking around here and watching this community grow in leaps and bounds. It has been wonderful to be a part of this with you. Now, Past Micah, take it away.
Thank you, Future Micah. And of course, you, our wonderful listener. Together, we have made a wonderful and growing community on Discord that I look forward to being a part of every day. Your generous support on Patreon has already greatly increased the quality of our podcast, including this very outro. As an extra little thank you, you can get episodes early along with a bunch of other cool perks. Please follow the link in the show notes to join our Discord, Patreon, and all of the other things I mentioned throughout this episode. If you would like to reach me directly, you can reach me through the Discord or by email at thewordinblackandred@gmail.com. Now, Future Micah, say the profound shit.
And thank you, Past Micah. Now go, knowing that the suffering we experience is sometimes just suffering, but how we choose to engage with it to help us love others and to prevent them from suffering the same makes all the difference. Shalom.